Welcome to the Modern Masculinity Podcast, where we delve into the depths of what it means to be a man in today's world, and we explore the real-life challenges and triumphs that you and I face every single day. My name is Hector Santi Esteban, and I come with no answers, only questions for some of the most wise, insightful, and grounded men that I know. So get settled in. You're listening to Modern Masculinity.
Fellas, what's going on? I hope this episode finds you well. And I hope this episode leaves you better than when it found you. And as always, I'm honored and humbled, grateful that I get to be a part of your journey and excited that you're here for this conversation. Today's episode is with Mr. Keith Edwards, and he's going to be a newly published children's author. But that is not what his life has been about. That's what his life is now about. But really, he is a guy who is perhaps the emblem of taking the turns and the twists and the chat that life gives us and essentially rolling with the punches. And he's made and turned his life into something that perhaps people could not have predicted even just a short little bit ago. And that's what this episode is about and how we as men can navigate these uncertainties that life is bound to throw at us. So appreciate y'all being here. I know you're going to enjoy today's episode. Let's get into it with Mr. Keith Edwards. Keith, welcome to the Modern Masculinity Podcast. Thanks for being here, my man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Let's jump right in. We've got some stuff that we want to talk about, but take us into your world. You've been fortunate enough to be working and seeing men develop over a number of decades. But All that to say, what I've learned in these conversations is that as much knowledge, information, research that we do, we still have our own journey to go through and we have our own work to do. So what's that look like for you today? Or what sort of things are pressing or challenging you in the moment?
Well, I'll give you two. The one I was thinking about today that I really am wrestling with, and to be honest, I wrestle with every day and an hour by hour, moment to moment, is I work for myself. I do my own thing. I'm a speaker, an author, and coach. And most of my day is trying to figure out, should I be more disciplined right now or should I be giving myself more grace right now? And when you have a boss or coworkers, there's external feedback like, wow, you've been working really hard. Like, we're good. We got this. When you work for yourself, I love the line of working for yourself is not like being your own boss. It's like being your own employee.
That's a good way to put it.
And so people say, what's it like not having a boss? They say, well, I have one. It's just me and we're working on our relationship. Yeah. So that's the one I was thinking about. The one really related to masculinity. And you're right. I've done almost 20 years of research on men's identity of masculinity. And that has not made me free from the external expectations or the shoulds. It has made me much more aware of that. And so I'm very aware of all the times I put on this shirt and go, how is this going to work for a podcast? And how is this manly enough? I don't really engage in that conversation too long. I don't take it too seriously, but I notice that I have it. Or why did I respond in that way? Or why did I give that example? And so I think just the noticing is really important. And in my research, which we should talk about a little bit more, we call that mask consciousness, the awareness that I'm wearing a mask, the awareness that I'm thinking about it. And that awareness is really critical.
Maybe that's where we'll go, because one of the things that's emerged out of this show is the need for us, the need for men to deprogram, to unprogram. There's this programming that's been given to us by society or our parents or school or whatever. And like you said, we're not even aware that we're running that program. We're not even aware that we have that software downloaded into us and that it's actually playing out. And that was my part of my own thing was like, I had to realize, why were these issues coming up in my life? Why were these starting to happen? Mm-hmm. And I could point my fingers at all the circumstances, but the common denominator was me. And I had to realize that the things that were running underneath in the background that was really driving most of these decisions. And it seems like that's right before that mass consciousness, like if you're not aware, but the first step is becoming aware that there are these other programmings going on.
I would say that programming is socialization. Participants talked about it as a mask. Let's get the boring stuff out of the way. 20-year research project, 10 men with very different identities and life experiences. I interviewed them when they were college men a number of times and have interviewed them every 5 years since. And so next summer, we'll be having our 20-year conversation. Continue to talk with them. And when I interviewed them, I asked, what are the expectations that society has of you as a man? And they were like, oh, blah, 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 blah. Like they just rattled that off. And great unanimity among them. And I said, when did you first learn this? And they would say, I've always known that. Because it's pre-consciousness, right? It's pre-memory, pre-before that. And we have research that shows that we socialize boys and girls differently in the 5 minutes after birth. Loving, caring parents when a baby cries, we treat that baby differently if it's a girl or if it's a boy. And I said, oh, this is what society expects of you, and you've always known it. How do you define that? And they would have similar but slightly different, a little bit more healthy versions of that. And we would talk about through that. And then some point in the second interview, they would do this thing where they would check to make sure it was just us, even though we were alone in a room. They'd be like, but that's not me. And be like, oh, yeah. And they'd look around again and I fake it. I go, oh, how do you do that? I lie about how much I drink. I pretend I don't study when I really do. I tell people I've hooked up with people I haven't hooked up with. Okay, all right. I swear. I lower my voice sometimes. They had all these strategies that they did to sort of pretend. And what was interesting is each of them thought they were the only one. Like for all the other men, this just comes naturally, right? And something's wrong with me because I'm too big or I'm too thin or I'm too smart or I'm not smart enough or whatever the thing is, whatever their insecurity about their masculinity was. And then their secret, and they thought they were the only one who did this, was I pretend. I put on this performance. I fake it. Or their metaphor was put on this mask so that everybody else will see me. And what I find really interesting about the masking is it had two purposes. One, I put on the mask to cover up who I am that I'm afraid you won't see as man enough. So I'm hiding behind that mask. I'm hiding my emotions. I'm hiding my insecurity to show you an image that you will see as man enough. So I'm hiding my vulnerability and then projecting an image forward around that. And once you have mass consciousness and you know that you do this and you know that pretty much every other guy does this, then what happens is you can do it with choice, right? So masking isn't always bad. If I'm in a job interview, probably not the best place to get into my messy divorce and how hard it is, right? That might be real and authentic and vulnerable, but put your mask on for the job interview, right? But if I notice I'm at happy hour with my three best friends and I'm avoiding the conversation about my messy divorce, maybe I should notice. Maybe this is the time to have that conversation and to not put on the mask and to be vulnerable and do that. And that's that mass consciousness. And you're talking about deprogramming. I think about it as learning. I also think about it as we have as men, as white people, as Americans, as parents, as fathers, right? We have a lot of shoulds that come along. And how do we get away from those shoulds and then separate from that those external messages? And then once you separate from those external messages, then it provokes powerful questions like, what does it mean to be a man separate from what Budweiser thinks it should be and all these other things, or my kindergarten teacher or my father or my friends or what I see at the gym? If I separate out all those external messages, then what do I think?
Yeah, it's hard as well for individuals, because when I'm in the midst of that process, and I'm still in the midst of that process, mm-hmm. I almost don't know who I am at first. There's a point where I don't know whether it's the mask or if it's me. And there were times, a variety of times over this last year, as of 2023, was really about unlearning and healing and going back to the really foundations, because I'd spent the first 30 years blasting on this track, going down this track, thinking that it was the track that I wanted to go down. Mm-hmm. And then I get halfway there or on the way, or the track blows up and it's, we can either rebuild the track to that same place and keep heading there, or we have this new opportunity to create a new destination. And it's in that moment where it's like, what do I want? Who am I? There was a real wrestling that was going on for days where I was just so indecisive with certain things that used to be, that's just what I do. That's who I am. And I'm sitting there going, well, is that me? You know, it was something like, I've talked about it a little bit, we're having some like relationship issues and things like that. And I find myself questioning, what is a man supposed to do? What role do they actually provide? And am I doing that because it's me? Or am I doing that because, like you said, Budweiser or Marlboro or whoever were these brands or businesses or whoever, these influences shaping what we think it is to be a man? And I'm glad that we're having these conversations, because at least now if a guy is in that spot where they're like, I don't know, like that's an okay place to be. I think we're all going there, or we all have to hit that point eventually, perhaps.
Yeah. One of the things I do is I'm a coach, and one of the simplest way to say what I do as a coach is I help people figure out, separate from the external expectations, what do you really want? Because like you're saying, most of us don't have time to think about that. When we do think about it, we really think about what we should want, what other people expect of us, what we've been successful at. We don't really figure out what we want. And then the downside of that is you can work your butt off to get somewhere, get there, and go, I don't even want to be here.
I feel like that's the track that most, I don't even say guys, a lot of people do, because they don't have this mass consciousness. They're just going full speed ahead down this track and then looking up and going, we got here. What was it all for? What was it worth?
Right. Oh, you can go to law school because that's what your parents did. And they already encouraged you and you got, and then you end up being a lawyer and you're like, oh my gosh, I don't want to do this. This is not right for me. Or you're just on a track and you've been dating someone for 3 years and it feels like it's time. And so you get married and then it's 2 years later and we should have kids. And then you have kids and you're just like, is this really what I wanted? And taking that time to figure out, what do I want? Because the most tempting paths, I think, are the ones that are affirming. Right. If it's an affirming path, right? Yeah. Validating. When someone says, Keith, I think you can be this incredible blah, 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 blah. And I go, wow. Oh my goodness. And you, and wow, that's awesome. That's super tempting. When someone says, Keith, you'll never amount to anything. But I go, I'll show you. Right. We sort of push back. But so I think being careful about scripts that are affirming and a compliment can be really tempting.
The other challenge is that we still live in a world where bills are paid, taxes are due. There's some real, as much as it would be great to go off into the desert and or go into the mountain or a cave, a lot of us have responsibilities. We've got kids, family, people that, that rely on us. I was talking to John D'Agostini, one of our first guests of the show, and he was talking about how a lot of men he's talking to are in these existential crises. And some of them are doing that. They're leaving their families. They're going to Tibet. They're going to India. They're going on these pilgrimages to try and find themselves because they're so lost. And I see that and I'm like, I don't know, how do we balance both our worldly kind of responsibilities with perhaps our spiritual destiny, if you will?
Yeah, and I think that can be great if you want to do that, or you have the resources to do that, or you have the luxury of doing that, but most of us don't. And I don't think it needs to be that dramatic. I think in my research, there's this sort of putting on the mask, right? And then when you have some mask consciousness and you go, oh, I'm wearing it, my uncle wears it, I don't know if I've ever seen my uncle without the mask, isn't that sad? Then we start to find moments when we unmask. In this intimate relationship, I can take my mask off and be myself, or when I'm with my family, or when I'm with my really good friends, or when I go to therapy. There's these moments where we can take the mask off. And then when we feel insecure about our manhood, it snaps back into place. There's another process that's a little bit more stable, which I call becoming. And the process of becoming is, who am I? And becoming is this iterative process. I think about it sort of the infinity symbol, the figure eight on its side, where on the left side is identity and the right side is integrity. And those two in conversation with each other. And identity is self-awareness. Who am I? Who do I want to be? Who do I aspire to be? And we can talk more about breaking that down. And then integrity is, what am I doing? Am I doing in alignment? Am I not doing in alignment? And I would have thought that we would figure out who we are, go to Tibet, figure out who I am, and then try and live up to that and fail and try and fail and try. And the research says it's not as unidirectional as that, that we think this is who I am, and then we try and be it, and we do or we don't. And then based on how we do or don't, then we change who we think we are. So I think I'm a very honest person, but I've lied 3 times this week. Should I try and lie less? Or do I maybe need to reconsider? Maybe I'm not the honest person that I think I am. Or I've been told my whole life I'm not a very good listener. I just think I'm not a very good listener. So that's my self-concept. But lately, people have been saying they feel really seen and heard when they're with me. So maybe I need to change my identity. Maybe I am a good listener now. And so that question of identity and integrity in conversation with each other, I think that's what helps us find our authentic masculinity, who we really are. And we can talk about toxic and healthy and authentic masculinity. But this process of identity, which is really self-awareness, and I break self-awareness down into self-discovery and self-creation, and then identity, which is self-management. And that you get accountability and feedback, and people say, you know, you claim you're this, but I don't really see it, right? You say you're really flexible, but you seem pretty rigid and structured, right? Or you make time for your family, but we haven't seen you. And when you are here, you're on your phone. So those in conversation. And I think that kind of thing, I worry a little bit about needing to escape from reality to find yourself. I think reality has a lot to offer, right? Changing diapers has a lot to offer. Trying to remember that Friday is trash day has a lot to offer. And just the day-to-day trials and tribulations have so much to teach us when we are conscious, when we are paying attention, when we are reflective. And I think that's sometimes hard to do in the hustle bustle of everything.
One of the things that I'm really curious about here, Keith, is how things have evolved. You know, 20 years in the grand scheme of things, obviously, is not a very long time. feel like so much has happened over that time. So much has shifted. If you go back to 2004 to 2024, I mean, life is just, it's totally different. Smartphones and Wi-Fi and social media and algorithms, Instagram, you name it. And so I'm curious, you mentioned people or the guys getting a little more perhaps authentic in relation to how they see these masks. And I'm curious if that came along with age, or if there are also some different sorts of progressions, or what else you've seen as the guys have gone through the process.
Well, the first thing I'd say is there are more than one mask, right? So there's the traditional definition of masculinity, and that's the one we all know. Be strong, don't cry, drink beer, drive trucks, things like that. And everybody knows that. Everybody's got that one. But then there are other definitions of masculinity. There's Black masculinity, there's rural masculinity, there's Latino masculinity. And so there's multiple versions of that. And for most men, they know the definition of masculinity, but it's not the only definition of masculinity. And that can be hard, right? If you're a Black college man who's in class with a white woman professor, but there's also other Black men in the class, like, which mask are you wearing and how do you do that? That's exhausting to navigate multiple masks. And some are navigating lots of them. And those masks shift and change. And each of those masks is plural, right? Because Black masculinity in rural Alabama is different than Black masculinity at a design firm in LA, and is different than Black masculinity at a community center in Minneapolis. So all of these are plural. And they do change over time, and they also don't change over time. So the specifics tend to shift a little bit, but not as much. And I think this is where men can learn a lot from the women's movement and feminist movement, which really expanded the possibilities for what women can be in quite radical ways. Still a long ways to go, but the expectations of men have not shifted very much at all. Maybe it's nuanced around the edges, but some of the foundational things are still there. The thing that has really shifted is social media, and you mentioned that, but when I was first interviewing them in 2000, social media was basically Facebook, and Facebook was basically college student, right? And so they talked later on in life about social media, when your grandma's on it and your boss is on it and your coworkers are on it, is a really different place than when it's only the other students at your college or university. And so social media became a place for them initially was where you proved your masculinity by these traditional definitions. And then it became I can't put that stuff up. And so that shifted and changed. And also things shift and change when you go from being a college student to having a job. And the context change, there were really three contexts that they talked about later in life. It was work, it was home, and it was social spaces. And so they would say, at work, I can't really do this stuff. I can't swear. I can't sexually harass people. There's the rules. And then at home, the people I live with, they've seen me at my worst. They've seen me at my best. Why would I pretend with them? It's my girlfriend and my sister. They've known me my whole life. Or it's my wife is the strongest person I've ever met. And so they could really be themselves there. And then in social spaces, at work, I'm pretty appropriate. And at home, I'm just who I am. And then I would say, well, what about social spaces? And they go, oh no. And they'd be like, on Thursday nights, I play soccer with my friends. And it's pretty much just the same stuff as when we were in college. The homophobia comes out, we kick like a girl. And those are things I'm just opposed to. But in that context, it all comes back out. One of the guys was telling me the story about he was promoted and he was leading a team of 50 now. And at his first team meeting, he told this powerful story about his values and how this pivotal story in college around really challenging sexual assaults in his fraternity and running to be president to get rid of that and get rid of those guys. And he's telling the story about integrity and values. And he's crying in his staff meeting of this first staff meeting. And he's telling this story because he's so proud of himself for really being authentic and showing emotion and this is who I am. And then 2 minutes later, he's telling me the story about the corporate golf outing the next Saturday where they were drinking beers in the car beforehand and all this misogyny and things like that. And he was just like, oh, like I thought I had evolved and I have, and I haven't at the same time. And so I think navigating how we are in different spaces can be really interesting in revealing the work we've done and the work we still have to do.
I think that there's a lot to that, right? Because I think that we as individuals, we can be honest, but lie sometimes. We can be reliable, but like there is a lot of instances where we can control and where we can't. I used to think I'm not an angry person, but I can get very angry. In fact, by me saying I'm not an angry person actually made that whole thing worse because it would get suppressed and it would spill out in all of the worst ways. And so I think there's this ideal and holding your ideal in the ideal, but then also realizing that there is this shadow part, that there's this other side of it that's there too. And finding a way to integrate those challenges, but also somebody who, you know, stands my ground, is willing to defend. The dichotomy of both of those has been a unique thing. And what's interesting is when you talk about masks, like one of the stories that came up early on is, or when you talk about it early in the episode, was the idea about masks. And I remember as a young kid, like middle school, everybody was trying to be like this tough guy. And it was so fake. It was so fake. Because for me, at least, I'm like, if anything goes down, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to throw a punch. I don't know how to really, know how to defend myself. I had played basketball and baseball, but when it came down to a physical confrontation, I was scared shitless. And I remember like fronting so hard. I knew that I didn't have any substance behind it. I would project such a strong mask because I knew that there wasn't something there. And so I'm having conversations with my son and he's, I don't want to go to wrestling and I don't want to go to jiu-jitsu and I don't whatever. And I get that too. But I also, in this particular instance, I'm like, I don't want you to ever feel like I did where you're not able to defend yourself and that you have to put on a mask in order to feel safe. So we're going to wrestling.
What would it mean to you to know that all those other guys were fronting too?
Yeah, well, yeah. And when I think about it, I know it. And I think I knew it back then too.
Yeah.
I had an intuition or I had a sense because you could see it, because it was always like whenever push came to shove or whenever anything happened, like you could see the people's true colors. And so I had an idea that I wasn't the only one, but I also had a feeling like there, but it still didn't change anything actually. Now that I think about it, like it didn't, I was still insecure and felt unsafe in that moment.
So, yeah. And I think that's what mass consciousness does when we become aware. And I think it's hard to do that when you're 13 to be aware, but also to believe it, right? You may be kind of knew it, but you didn't know it. I think when you're older and you recognize the masks that you wear and you see it in others and you know it, then the guy who's bragging about all the women he's hooked up with, he's just like, I doubt it. And so many stories about men lying about hookups, lying about drinking, lying about not studying, not buying the book, not going to class. And then later in life, it became about, they were still competing, but it wasn't about drinking and hooking up. Now it was about money and status. It was about how much money people made. Nobody really says the number, but they put some stuff out there so they know, or the number of people who report to me, or my scope of influence, or how many clients I've brought in, or status, titles, things like that. So they found themselves still competing. The way I say it, they were still playing the game. The scoreboard just changed, right? Instead of points, now it's money. Instead of hookups, it's this. Instead of getting blackout drunk, now it's whatever the case may be. Those things shifting. And what you were pointing to before about the messiness of that, I see the messiness of having incredible capacity to be a teacher, right? I'm a nice guy, but I was super direct with that person. What's that about, right? Do I need to change my self-image as a nice guy? Maybe I want to be an assertive guy. Maybe I don't want to be a nice guy. Or do I need to change my behavior? Do I want to handle that situation differently the next time? Not seeing ourselves as finished, as works in progress. I have a great mentor who's incredibly accomplished, was on my dissertation committee and has written many books and done lots of things. And if he were on the podcast and you would intro him, the last line of his bio is always, and he is wildly unfinished. And I love that. And I had an experience when I was in grad school, my grandfather taking me to the airport and he said, what is it that you're doing in grad school? I said, I'm learning to help college students figure out who they are. And I was like, damn, that is a good answer, right? That's impressive. And I looked at it and I was like ready for him to be impressed. He was 74 at the time and he was impressed, but not with me, but with the college students. He said, yeah, I think I'm still trying to figure out who I am. And I remember looking at him just going, oh shit, I'm going to have to do this for the rest of my life. Because I thought I was finished because I had just finished being a college student. I was like, I'm done. I'm finished. This is great. And he just put back in my face, no, you're going to spend the rest of your life trying to figure out who you are. And that was both scary and demoralizing, but also exciting. I don't have to come to an answer. It's about the journey.
As you're saying this, I'm wondering, and it's probably both, they usually are, how much of this whole thing is discovering who you are, and then how much of it is deciding who you are?
Absolutely. So I break this down. So the integrity, the doing is self-management. The identity is self-awareness. And I break self-awareness into two parts. self-discovery and self-creation. So if you think about the timeline of your life, 0 to maybe 100, maybe more, maybe less, and then wherever you are on that timeline, and then self-discovery is everything from now in the past. Where did I grow up? Parents got divorced when I was 9, broke my arm when I was 10, fell in love here, changed my major here. What are all of the things that you have experienced in your life that have helped shape you? That's self-discovery. And that's so important to create a real understanding of our traumas and our successes and what went well and what didn't go well and what shaped us so that we're not puppets to them. The more aware we are of how those things are affecting us, then we can wrestle with them. But then the next part is from wherever you are on the timeline forward, that's self-creation. What are my values? What choices do I want to make? Where do I want to go? What do I want to care about? What do I not want to care about? And that self-creation is where we have agency. And I think both are super, super important, because if you don't do the self-discovery work, then you're trying to build a house on a crappy foundation and it's just going to fall apart. But if all you do is the self-discovery and you don't do the self-creation, you're a victim to your circumstances, right? And this is oversimplified, but therapy is a great place to do the self-discovery. What has happened to you and how is it affecting you? Coaching is a great place to do the self-creation. Where do you want to go now? What do you want to create? What do you want to live into? What are your values? Where are you out of integrity? Where do you need accountability? You can do both of those, but being very clear. And I think some of us have done a lot of self-discovery work or not much at all.
Do you see those as things that you would shift in terms of, obviously we're oversimplifying stuff, but if we're just talking generally focused, is it something where you focus on the self-discovery and then that leads to a phase more of deciding what you would call it, and then you maybe switch back? Is it something that you see is being done both at the same time? How do you see those fitting together?
I think it's more of a conversation, kind of going back and forth. I'm 47. I have a PhD. I have looked at a lot of different things in my life, and I'm regularly reminded of life experiences that I haven't thought about in 20 years. I'd totally forgotten that happened. Or I have experiences where I share with my parents, oh, remember when da-da-da, like that totally shaped me, blah, 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 and that, you know, it's not how I remember it. Oh, I remember it completely differently. So I think going back and forth and shifting that, because there's at times in life when the most important thing is X, and then 5 years later, you don't care about X anymore at all. And all you care about is Y. And so where is that kind of shaping you? And then that's also where the unlearning comes in, right? I was really bullied when I was in high school. And I learned some strategies that really helped me navigate through that. And they don't serve me today. So how do I unlearn pretending that you have confidence, pretending you're never vulnerable, never let them see your weakness, which is what I learned to navigate through that. And that doesn't help me be a good partner or a good father. So I've got to unlearn that lesson that was good and served me and worked. And I think that's hard, unlearning the things that have served us. And I think a lot of that is our baggage and our trauma. And when we talk about deprogramming or unlearning or healing, most of that healing work is recognizing the lessons we've learned and then unlearning them. I'll give you a quick example. One of my coaching clients was a serious leader in the nonprofit sector, and he would get nominated to be on all these boards and important positions, and he would always turn them down. And he would tell you, because he's a white man and he didn't want another white man taking up space, because those were his values, which is true. But then through our coaching, he realized that when he was a boy, his father beat the crap out of him and his brother. And he learned that when dad came home, if he was small or hid or was as invisible as he could be, he could be safe and his dad would beat up his brother and not him. And what he realized, his dad is now dead, but he is still trying to be small and invisible. So it's a really different, once you have that awareness, then when he gets nominated for a board, he can say, I value equity and inclusion. Is that why I am going to turn this down or not? Or am I still hiding from my dad? And I don't want my dad making decisions for me. When you have that awareness, now you have conscious choice to, okay, I'm going to say no, but that reason is that thing that I learned that served me really well that no longer serves me. Let's let my values make this decision. And that gets interesting.
I wasn't abused as a kid, but I love my mom. She's a great mom and she's a great grandma. But she was very my way or the highway. You did it her way and that was it. And if you didn't, it was going to be an ordeal, because it was. And so I just learned to people please and to do what you say and to shut my own interests and desires and wants and just put them all away, because it was just going to keep the house peaceful.
Yeah.
And the challenge is that I now bring that same sort of thinking into decisions that have nothing to do, like you said, have nothing to do with that sort of interaction.
I bet you're not really good at self-care.
For sure. That's why this year was so big, because I had to
be selfish. Yes. in a great way, right?
Yeah, I can't even say it, but yeah, I had to start taking the time, or there was even times where I'd feel bad leaving in the morning to work out, like that sort of stuff.
And we can extend that. That's about you. We can then extend to your mom, like, why was she my way or the highway? Probably because when she was a kid, what maybe did she need to unlearn to open some of that up? And there's judgment. I always find when there's judgment, where's the empathy there, right?
And that's huge too. And I've talked a lot about my own upbringing only because that's my own experience of one, but also realizing that in that she was doing the best that she could. And it's an interesting thing. You see some of these memes about millennials, because it's like millennials are this weird group that a lot of them are caring for their parents and their kids. Mm-hmm.
Sandwich.
Yeah. And they're having to reparent themselves while taking care of these other generations. And it's just, I think it's mind fucking a lot of people, because there's so many programming or learnings that have gone on either. And no one is actually saying it either, that, oh yeah, there are these things that are probably fucking up your marriage or your parenting, or like these things that are getting in the way.
Well, I just assume that they are. Right? Like, we all have them. We all have these scripts, these things that we've been told, whether it's as men or as women or as white people or as black people or as Minnesotans, right? And how do we break free from that? And then also, what are the things I think about it as, some people talk about it as computer programming running in the background. I think about it as like a puppet, like someone's hand is just up the back of my head doing that. And I don't want that. I want to be in control. I want to be in charge. But if I just pretend I'm in charge, that's not being in charge, right? What is going on? What is driving my inclination? What is driving that when I'm uncomfortable in this conversation, I turn to my phone? That's not what I want to do. Why do I do that? It's a way of escaping. It's a way of not being here by being here. Okay, what's that about? And how do I unlearn that? And so this is where I think mindfulness is just such a great teacher, just like being aware. Oh, I'm uncomfortable. And when I'm uncomfortable, I do this. Why am I uncomfortable? Oh, this reminds me of getting bullied in high school. Oh, this isn't that. Okay. And then you give yourself a little grace. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Or the last three times the conversation went this way, it didn't go well. So you're just trying to get out of this as fast as you can. Oh, and I think our bodies have a lot to teach us about our emotions.
What I've found is that mindfulness has been huge for me, and some sort of meditation and contemplative practice, because it gives you that space between whatever is stressing you and the response, or whatever is making you feel a sort of way and the response. And what's interesting that I've noticed is that a lot of times we'd have this thing that gives us anxiety. We have some sort of physiological response, and we go straight to whatever the number is, scrolling the phone, weed, booze, porn, like whatever people go to. And what's interesting is they don't, at least for me, the key has been to notice that physiological response, like to take that middle moment and go, oh, this is what's happening, and not just go straight to the number, right? Because I think a lot of people, they skip that, or that step happens so quickly that they don't even realize that the reason that they're scrolling is because they're anxious, or the reason that they're doing whatever is because of this other thing that happened.
One of my favorite books is The Book of Joy, which is a book about a conversation, a week-long conversation between the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And very different religious perspectives, both generational genocide, assassination attempts. They have a lot in common and a lot different. But one of the things they talk about is a sacred pause is the difference between reactivity and response. And when we're reactive, we're not usually our best selves. And when we're choosing a response, that's really different. So when someone says something, we know when we're reactive, right? Like hot, face flush, doesn't matter. I'm gonna say it, I'm gonna do it, or go to my phone. And a sacred pause can be so many things, but it's just a little pause that lets you step out of being reactive, which is a bodily experience, heart rate, all of this stuff, right? We all do it differently, but we all have that thing till you can get to a place where you can choose a response. So someone steps on my shoes at a concert, I can be reactive, or I can take a pause and be like, it's not a big deal, probably didn't mean it. Or if they did, I'm going to go somewhere else. I don't want to deal with this, right? There's a response. And that sacred pause can be so many things. It can be a breath. It can be count to 10 before you, it can be don't respond to shitty emails until tomorrow. It can be give 24 hours after the fight before you attempt to repair. It can be meditation. It can be sleep. It can be get outside, go for a walk, do a loop around the block, right? But that sacred pause, whatever it takes to separate, and sometimes it takes heartbeat, right? And sometimes it takes a couple of days to get out of that reactivity into the response.
Yeah, I think it's important for guys to build that in. Recently, I've been waking up and just jumping in the cold shower. Mm-hmm. I live in SoCal, so cold showers aren't always cold in the summer, but they're actually cold enough right now to be cold. And that for me has been that sacred pause in the morning, because I wake up and I had a guest on for another show recently. He said that when he wakes up, he feels like he's in the jungle in Nam. Like he feels like he's in a firefight. And so he's got to actively take his nervous system down. Yeah. For me, when I wake up, I feel, and I don't know if this is always, but I feel in a much more of a depressed, like sad kind of state. Like I've got to get those out. And when I hop in the shower, it's terrible for 3 minutes, but I get out and it's that pause that, that allows me to shift into something that I want to be more. Before we hopped on the call, I took another call out walking down kind of our thoroughfare where there's some grass, and I live in SoCal, so we can still walk in the grass barefoot right now. But like doing things like that, that seem inconsequential, but actually when done consistently, they're game changers.
What's important is finding what those things are for you, right? Right. It's not that showers, right? That works for you. That's great. It's not walking barefoot in the grass, but that works for you. For someone else, it might be. For me, exercise is really great. My clarity before a workout and after a workout, and a workout doesn't really have to be much. Sometimes sleep, a quick nap on the other side, sometimes just a deep breath. I know a lot of people who meditate use a particular posture or a hand thing when they meditate. And sometimes you can just do that thing again before the meeting. Just put your fingers like you do it and you go, oh, I know this state. Okay. All right. Yeah. So I think for folks who are listening, not a particular strategy, but find yours and find 3 to 5 of them. Because sometimes you can't do it before the meeting, right? You can't hop in a cold shower before the meeting, but you could do that breathing routine, or you could do this thing, or you could sit down, or you can imagine that special place on the beach that you love to go to that just brings you calm. Like you can go there in your head. But these are great self-management tools when you feel out of alignment with who you aspire to be, to bring you back to that and learn from it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've just built them into my day. Mm-hmm. I've tried to create times throughout the day where those things have become habit and routine, where it's like in the morning we get up, cold shower, hit the gym or go jujitsu or whatever it is, get all that stuff out of the way so that by the time it's time to take the kids to school, if I've gotten to that routine and done that before school time drop off, it's a 720 degree difference.
This is why that self-care and being selfish is a generous thing you do for others, right? Because if you do all that selfish stuff, you're a better dad. You're a better partner. Your people are going to be irritating you on the highway and you'll be better response, right? Self-care as community service, I think, is a beautiful way to think about this. I'm not doing this because I'm self-involved. I'm doing this so I can be better for everybody today. And then notice when you're not at your best, right? Oh, geez, like I'm pretty reactive. What do I need to do to get reconnected with that so that we can be at our best? It's just a reframing that selfishness as a negative thing into this is what I do for others, right? I get up and I hop in the shower so I can be a really good dad.
I'd love to finish off with you mentioned that you're about to do your 20-year, you know, questioning. And I'm curious what your, whether it's your outlook or your hypotheses or the direction, if you could catch us up onto where the state of the study is now and where that might go.
Yeah, the first, they were in college, so they're roughly 20. The 5-year follow-up, they were roughly 25 and then 30 and 35. And this one, they'll be roughly 40. So where they are in life, I don't know where they will be, but where they were at 35 is a lot of them are settling in. So in college, they were really masking, how am I not good enough? And then how do I pretend to be? At 25, they were really exploring. Is this the relationship I want to be in? Is this the work I want to do? They were experimenting, dabbling, trying lots of different things, moving to different cities. At 30, they were starting to get serious about relationships, maybe parenthood. They were starting to settle in. I think I've found my thing now. How do I do it? At 35, they were wrestling with this relationship, with this parenting, with this job, and trying to figure out how they could. They'd figured out who they were, and now they're having their focus was less on 25. Their who am I was this. The most pressing question. At 35, they had a sense of that, but they weren't good at being it consistently. And so integrity was really the thing. I mostly prioritize my family, but I've got a couple of friends and we just do dumb shit together. Or I mostly am in integrity at work, but there's a few situations where I just get pulled out of that and I want to stop that. And so the self-work in the last round of interviews was more around less about who I am and more how do I do this consistently? Or how do I do this as a father of three? Like, it's one thing to figure out me, but now I've got three kids and oh my goodness, and how do I do that? And what do I teach them? And exploring some new tools. So people were meditating or reading meditations by Marcus Aurelius or the Daily Stoic or going to church, or there's so many things that people were finding to help them reconnect with the best version of themselves and then be it more often. And then when you're not, don't be frustrated, right? Hey, I'm not at my best. How can I learn from that?
Yeah. It's a great just, you know, micro macrocosm of life, you know, the hero's journey. This has been so fun, Keith. I appreciate you coming in and sharing this wisdom with us. If people want to go deeper in your world, find more about you, I think you've even got a show of your own. Where's the best place to go?
The best place is keithedwards.com. There's blog posts on lots of these different things that are there. You can find the book Unmasking Toward Authentic Masculinity wherever you get books. It's on Amazon. It's on Bookshop. It's on Audible. It's on all those places. You can find more about it at the website. The best way to connect with me is I do every 2 weeks a newsletter called Sharing Fire. It's really short. It's totally free. No nonsense, no pitches. And it's just, what am I thinking? What am I learning? What am I contributing? And what am I being inspired by? So that's a simple, easy way to stay connected with the different things that I'm doing.
And we'll link all that stuff up in the show notes as well. Last question for you here, Keith. In your opinion, what's the definition of modern masculinity?
Authentic masculinity. And so I distinguish that. There's toxic masculinity, which is drink beer, eat meat, drive a truck, all of that stuff that we know. Then there's healthy masculinity, which we promote as being honest and respectful and more positive versions, which I think is great for lots of reasons. But even healthy masculinity is externally imposed. It's maybe a better mask, but it's still a mask. So my definition of modern masculinity is, what does it mean to you to be a man? I'm not interested in telling, I'm interested in asking. And your answer to that would be different than mine. And your answer to that next month would be different than it is today. And so how do we keep asking, what does this mean for me? Being a man is a really important part of who I am, but I want to choose what that means. I don't want external things imposing that on me, which I live in the world. So it's constantly telling me who I should be and who I shouldn't be, what I should think, feel, and behave and not think, feel, and behave. And how do I let go of that and figure it out for myself is a constant thing I'm wrestling with.
Great stuff here. Fellas, I want to thank you for being here with us and sticking with us. If you made it this far, we would love and appreciate a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. If you know somebody who needs to hear this, if you know a guy who's going through some stuff, or maybe they got some changes in their life, hit that share button, send them a text, let them know that you were thinking about them. And as always, we appreciate you being part of the tribe. We'll see you on the next one. Later, y'all.